Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Welcome to Solving the Puzzle with Dr. Datis Karazian, informing you about evidence-based strategies for autoimmune disease, brain health issues, Hashimoto's hypothyroidism, gut health problems, and many other chronic health conditions. If you enjoy this podcast, you can find more information on today's episode and other topics at drknews.com.
So when you look at the female hormone transitions into menarche, menstruation, and perimenopause, there's just some key numbers just to make sure you know about. So puberty onset at age 10 and 13 is normal with average age of 11. Menarche, onset of menstruation, onset is usually at age 12 to 4 with the average of age of 13. And then perimenopause onset is age 45 to 50 with the average age of 50. And perimenopause can be 3 months or it could be 10 years, but the average is about 3 to 4 years. And the menopause onset is at age 50 to 58 with the average age of 51. And then some people get into premature menopause where they get into menopause at like age 35, age 40. And those are always red flags for autoimmune patterns where they have ovarian antibodies, premature ovarian destruction of their ovaries leading into menopause. Okay. Now, when we look at the female hormone transition patterns, we get into early onset puberty, delayed onset puberty. In the same case with males in early ages, they have early onset puberty, delayed puberty. We really want to review some of the basic concepts here. Now, you're not going to see a lot of these, I would say, in a functional medicine practice, but you should be aware of some of these things. So some parents will have some concerns about some of their children, how they're developing, and so forth. But ultimately, somewhere around age 8, there are these quetzpeptin cells, the hypothalamus, and then they start to stimulate the pituitary hypothalamic pathways and start producing LH and FSH, and this then leads to testosterone and estrogen production, and male and female characteristics will then start to develop as they get into their puberty stages. Puberty in boys starting a little bit later than girls, and then that age group like 10 to 17. So there's a wide range here of puberty development. And when you look at how sexual development is measured with milestones and age in years in between males and females, you can see, for example, a breast budding is age 8 to 13, growth of the scrotum testes somewhere around 10 and a half to age 17. There's a long length of broad age period for these things. A lot of times parents get worried, but they're not really outside childhood milestones. And in cases where they are, though, if someone's outside these milestone age periods, they need to be checked out by a pediatric endocrinologist. This is not really a functional medicine game. So if you see that they're having breast budding before age 8, for example, or changes in their voice much earlier, or even much later, they're not getting the first menstrual cycle by age 17, not getting to menarche by age 17, there's some concerns. So the first thing is to really have this evaluated by a qualified pediatric endocrinologist. And the goal is to really look at pathology. When you look at pediatric guidelines for delayed puberty development, boys greater than 14 or girls greater than 13 without breast buds, or boys greater than 14 without testes, they need to look at conditions. Now, obviously, things like celiac disease and Crohn's disease, you can pick up with in a functional medicine model pretty quickly. But there could be structural changes in the brain. They can have hypopituitaryism. There's underlying malignancies that can occur in this age group that can lead to changes in puberty timing. There could be perineuroplastic conditions, some genetic causes, some severe environmental issues. So anytime someone's outside the milestones, make sure they get proper evaluation for pathology-associated patterns. Okay. Now, if you have changes in development different than average changes, that could still cause some suspicion to you as a healthcare practitioner. You'll just see some women and men, you see some boys and girls that are just not developing as quick as other boys and girls, and that's still maybe within a normal period of time. People do grow differently, but one of the things you might want to do is just look at the average. And if you see some abnormalities in the change of like the average development, average growth, you may want to just look at general function and general health as well. So remember that when you look at females, typically begin puberty around ages 10 through 11 and then puberty around ages 15 to 17. The major landmark of puberty in females is menarche, the onset of menstruation, which occurs between ages 12 and 13. Primary amenorrhea refers to absence of menstruation in someone who has not had a period for since age 15. And a lot of times you will have people who have like developmental delays. They'll go to their pediatrician and go, oh, we'll just keep waiting. We'll have to see what's going on. And there could be a time to really come in and try to look at diet, nutrition, lifestyle and see if you can do things to optimize their endocrine system just because they're off average and they're starting to show patterns that could be suspicious of abnormal endocrine development. Males begin puberty around age 10 through 11, end around 16 or 17. For males, first ejaculation, spermarchy occurs at around age 13. And ultimately, when you look at these childhood developmental delays and early onset patterns, the most common cause is really BMI. So this was a study that was conducted called Age of Menarche in the Longitudinal U.S. Cohort. They looked at 1,257 young girls enrolled at 68 years at the age of age. And then from 2004 to 2007, they followed them up with at least annually through 2014. And bottom line was we found that increased BMI had a greater effect on age at early menarche. Then did race and ethnicity providing more evidence to support efforts to address the obesity epidemic among children in the United States? Last, girls with earlier breast maturation experienced a slower tempo through puberty, which would potentially could affect adult morbidity through expanded window of susceptibility. And what they're finding is increased rates of early obesity that changes these milestone patterns also can increase things like risk for PCOS and cardiovascular disease down the road. This was a study of 1,458 Italian girls that were born between 1995 and 2003, and they basically looked at these girls over a period of time. Our data confirmed significant relationship between BMI and age of early breast button and menarche. We know that one of the key things is this model of that's proposed between endocrine pathways linking childhood obesity and insulin resistance to early puberal onset and immaturity. Adipose tissue is part of the metabolic endocrine system. And for the most part, when there's increased body fat, increased BMI, there is greater potential to have insulin resistance and change in sex hormone-binding globulin levels, also the accumulation of like endocrine-disrupting chemicals. So when you're seeing like any type of earlier, even delayed puberty issues, obesity is really the main thing. So this was a paper that was titled, "Is the cause relationship between obesity and puberty?" They said obesity is associated with early onset of larger young girls, and boys who were overweight seem to mature earlier, and boys who were obese seem to mature later than boys at healthy weights. The mechanism associated with how body fat changes puberty timing and how it can impact these rates in precocious puberty. Now, the other key thing is endocrine-disrupting chemicals. So this is a paper that looked at the association of prenatal childhood between PBD exposure, fire retardant chemicals, with the timing of puberty in boys and girls. In this study, they measured serum concentrations of fire retardants in blood collected from mothers during pregnancy and their children at age 9. And they go on to say, we determined timing of puberty onset in 309 boys and 340 girls using clinical Tanner staging every 9 months between 9 and 13 years of age and the time of menarche by self-report. In conclusion, we found evidence that prenatal exposure to the PBDE flame retardants found in the Penta-PDE mixture widely used in home furnishings may be associated with later puberty in girls and earlier puberty in boys. All of this finding does not help explain the observed phenomena of early onset of puberty in girls. It suggests that the ubiquitous exposure may nonetheless be impacting children's pubertal development. And that's the key thing, is like, when you see things off average, it could be a clue to that the BMI is impacting the endocrine system, which will have consequences down the road, or that they may be getting exposed to some of these endocrine-disrupting chemicals. And then studies are showing even, you know, prenatal exposure to environmental chemicals may be having significant impacts on puberty development, the main one being prenatal impact of different obesogens that then impact children where they have increased body weight and have obesity in early childhood from these obesogens and endocrine-disrupting chemicals that then lead into the whole increased body fat, increased leptin, increased aromatase, increased storage for endocrine-disrupting chemicals, decreased sex hormone-binding globulin patterns, all the shifts that take place that can then change puberty timing. And then, of course, there's a genetic uniqueness that's also associated with these, so there will be some population of children that are more prone to it than others. But any kind of delay that a parent notices should always be a red flag. As soon as you see a delay with children that are having any kind of milestone development, you should at the very least think about supporting their microbiome, giving them phase one, phase two detoxification support. It's just as a nutraceutical they can use daily. You want to try to reduce their chemical load in their house. Those are always just good things to do anyways. When you look at the web of abnormal puberty, we have the potential for these for endocrine-disrupting chemicals that then may lead to increased fat storage, obesity, or other lifestyle factors that lead to obesity. And then increased body fat allows for a greater storage of endocrine-disrupting chemicals. In combination with dysbiosis, impaired microbiome transformation, all things that may impact puberty timing. So the main issues you really want to think about clinically in a functional medicine model is reduce chemical load, optimize BMI, support phase one, phase two detox, try to get their gut as healthy as possible. Okay. Now, gynecomastia is another thing to consider. This is critical with males, and it's definitely become more prevalent and more common. This is the classification of gynecomastia, normal, and then you can see more of a budding and a drooping in grade four, the most extreme stage. And it's basically overdevelopment, enlargement of breast tissue in men or boys. It becomes larger as they grow. They many times grow unevenly. It's really that pointed appearance. That's the major clue that this is really abnormal hormone function. If you look at the literature, it's definitely increasing over time. This was the observational 20-year national registry study of 17,000 subjects. And they go over 20 years. From 1998 to 2017, there has been a five-fold increase in gynecomastia among young men aged between 16 and 20 years old. But for elderly men, the report showed a bigger 11-fold increase in the diagnosis of gynecomastia across a 20-year period. These are aromatized men that are aromatizing. These are definitely promoted by estrogens and endocrine-disrupting chemicals and also just by body fat itself. So these are the trends in annual incidence of gynecomastia among males according to specific age groups from 1998 to 2017. And you can see these spikes. 16 to 20-year-olds have a huge spike in this age group. The first spike is the 16 to 20-year-old, you know, group. And then as when men start to be past age 60, they become another group where you have this potential exposure to these estrogen-stimulating breast tissue proliferative patterns leading to gynecomastia. This was, they go on to show in the study, the conclusion was that the incidence of gynecomastia dramatically increased over the last 20 years, implying that endogenous, exogenous, sex steroid hormones has changed. So basically men producing too much estrogen, aromatization, endocrine-disrupting chemicals. Now, if anyone has gynecomastia, they do need to get a thorough workup. And when you look at idiopathic or unknown cause of gynecomastia or physiologic gynecomastia, it accounts for 50%. But as some men get older and they get things like liver cirrhosis, and there's some cases of tumors and hypogonadism and chronic renal insufficiency, that may be one of the reasons why they can't clear out their hormones very effectively, and they get this estrogen buildup, and they develop this gynecomastia pattern. So in a clinical setting, like using things like selective estrogen receptor modulators, there's looking at things to support biotransformation, looking at things to help support the 2,4-16 metabolites like DIM, endothricarbinol. Those can be important, as well as just biotransformation, microbiome function as well, or support. Okay, in the majority of cases, puberty gynecomastia observation and reassuring or maintenance of therapy as the condition usually resolved naturally. Pharmacological treatment and surgery recommended only in selected cases. In some cases of gynecomastia, they do respond naturally. They resolve, not always perfectly. They don't always restore, but sometimes it looks like they're getting really bad and they calm down as far as the grade of what their gynecomastia is. In some cases, they'll have to use like aromatase inhibiting medications, and they'll just do surgery to just remove that tissue. But it goes back to this web associated with endocrine-disrupting chemicals, obesity, high amounts of estrogen storage, leading into gynecomastia. So for puberty, you're basically dealing with endocrine-disrupting chemicals, increased body mass indexes, and impaired biotransformation pathways. Now let's get into females. Let's talk about menstruation. When you're looking at menstrual cycle abnormalities, you're having some dysfunction in normal menstrual cycle. And when you look at the menstrual cycle, there has to be a series of steps that take place that work like a domino effect, one triggering the next and triggering the next. So if pregnancy doesn't take place at the end of the cycle, you'll have a drop in estrogen and a drop of progesterone. This leads to the death of the endometrial lining, lack of blood flow, and then the shedding, and then menses, right? Hormone levels drop. And when these hormone levels drop and menses takes place, that hormone drop is then going to stimulate the pituitary to release follicle-stimulating hormone. And follicle-stimulating hormone is going to then stimulate the follicle, and here you can see FSH levels going up and starting to go up. As FSH is starting to go up, you start to see the follicle producing estradiol. This is in the first half of the cycle. So this is ovarian follicle estradiol production. And at some point, you have what's called an estradiol peak. And this estradiol peak is going to promote LH surge. The LH surge is then going to promote ovulation, and then the follicle becomes a corpus luteum. And then the corpus luteum is going to put out progesterone throughout the second half of the cycle, which is going to be continually stimulated by luteinizing hormone. And then you have this progesterone output throughout the cycle. And then again, if pregnancy doesn't take place, the endometrium tissues change, hormone levels drop, and this whole cycle starts over and over again. You should remember that in a female hormone cycle, testosterone levels are pretty much very stable all the way out through, right around mid-cycle. There's a little bit of spike, but they're pretty stable throughout this. And you should also know the most common cause of menstrual hormone imbalance and infertility in females is polycystic ovarian syndrome. And sometimes the easiest way to find this is to do a random testosterone check, like with, for example, a serum testosterone check, right in some point in the follicular phase and some point in the luteal phase, and see if it's spiking or abnormal. That'd be a very good way to identify things like PCOS. Because if the testosterone levels are abnormal, you can see some shifts in all the other hormones that are involved with PCOS pathophysiology. And we look at the menstrual cycle itself. The estrogen is really leading to repair, regeneration. Progesterone is really causing secretion of compounds and nutrients and creating an environment to allow for implantation to take place for a healthy pregnancy. And if these pregnancy doesn't take place, these levels drop. Menses takes place with a sudden drop of estrogen and progesterone. And the estrogens are involved with proliferative phase. Progesterone is really creating a suitable nutrition substrate for possibly fertilization. And this is important too, because if someone has heavy bleeding, what does that really mean? Someone has light bleeding, what does that really mean? So if someone has lots of proliferation, lots of estrogens in the first phase of the cycle, not enough antagonist progesterone, they could have periods of really heavy bleeding. If they're not making enough estrogen, or they're making way too much progesterone, or their timing of estrogen progesterone is off, they could have light menstrual cycles. So whenever someone's telling you they have heavy or light menstrual cycles, you really have to consider what's happening in the follicular phase, what's happening in the luteal phase. And then we'll get into these different menstrual cycle abnormalities. But one of the things we should talk about first is like PMS, PMDD, and then menstrual migraines. And one of the most important things you need to know about with like premenstrual syndrome, which is dysmenorrhea, like painful cramping and menstruation, is many of these are very clearly prostaglandin imbalances. This goes back to the essential fatty acid pathways. So this was a paper that was published called Inflammatory Markers in Dysmenorrhea and Therapeutic Options, and they go on to say that despite numerous studies, the pathomechanism of dysmenorrhea is not fully understood. Previous research indicates the complexity of biochemical reactions between endocrine vascular and immune systems. Prostaglandins play a major role in the pathomechanism of dysmenorrhea. For example, omega-6, omega-3, omega-9 levels being illustrated here, and the formation of things like arachidonic acid and prostaglandins, and it's really not just hormones themselves, but these prostaglandins that really play a role in vasoconstriction and myometrial contractions and ischemia, lowering pain threshold and pain. So when there's prostaglandin imbalances, that's when you can get abnormal contractions, that's when you can get increased pain. And it's always a red flag that someone that has MS patterns and dysmenorrhea patterns, lots of pelvic pain and lots of discomfort before their menstrual cycle, that they really have an essential fatty acid imbalance. It's not really typically an estrogen or progesterone imbalance. Prostaglandins play a role in myometrial contractions and impacting things like blood flow and uterine contraction activity and ischemia. So, for example, if there's imbalance of the ratios between pro-inflammatory prostaglandins and not the right ratios of omega-6, 3, and 9, you can have people that have lots of discomfort before they have their menstrual cycle. And then the typical things when you see that are directly related to PMS patterns are many times things that impact prostaglandins, specifically fried food, fast food, inflammatory foods that have some role. Now, there is a more aggressive condition of premenstrual syndrome called premenstrual dysphoric disorder. And this is where not only do they have like pelvic pain issues, but they have much more severe brain neurological mood disorders. And PMS affects 95% of women. PMDD affects 10% of women. And these are women that may have underlying neuroinflammatory conditions or some kind of neurochemical imbalances, or underlying neurological autoimmunity or past head injury that's causing them to be in an inflamed state. And when they get their PMS patterns, they're much, much worse. So anytime someone has actual, you really want to make sure you do a really thorough evaluation of their brain history and look for past brain injuries and things that cause neuroinflammation, potentially even neurological autoantibodies, and see what's there. Another key thing that can happen is menstrual migraines right before. A menstrual migraine affects 20 to 25% of female migrainers in the general population and 20 to 70% of patients representing headache clinics. And what they find with is the peak migraine incidence is right here, right before the luteal phase. Here's ovulation here. And two pathophysiological mechanisms have been identified, which is estrogen withdrawal, meaning estrogen levels dropping, and prostaglandin releases. So this is another prostaglandin imbalance as well. So prostaglandin imbalance, inability to get estrogen levels maintained throughout the cycle, a combination of both in particular seems to be a pathophysiology of menstrual migraine. So when we look at these like premenstrual patterns, like PMS, PMDD, menstrual migraines, we know that there's definitely a prostaglandin, essential fatty acid relationship between them. With those that have PMDD, you have to suspect underlying neuroinflammatory conditions or neurochemical imbalances that are there that are making this much, much worse. And then with menstrual migraine, definitely prostaglandin imbalances and the ability to really maintain their progesterone estrogen levels throughout their cycle. Those are, seems to be the main things. Now, there's also a new condition that's controversial, and that's called postmenstrual syndrome. And then some people don't think it's really real. It's just premenstrual syndrome because at the end of one cycle is the beginning of the next cycle. But postmenstrual syndrome is a term used to describe symptoms that arise after a person's period ends. And this is most likely associated with people that just have depletion after the menstrual cycle. Like iron levels drop, they get mineral depletion, their blood sugar, adrenal system gets exhausted. Those may actually be real underlying mechanisms of people that actually have postmenstrual syndrome where they totally fall apart at the end of the menstrual cycle. It's not really a PMS thing. In those scenarios, you want to look for iron deficiencies, minerals, and adrenal support. Those are the things you definitely want to be thinking about clinically more than anything else. Now, when you look at menstrual disorders themselves, look at dysmenorrhea, menorrhagia, oligomenorrhea. So menstrual cramps, dysmenorrhea, heavy bleeding, menorrhagia, irregular periods, menorrhagia, infrequent periods, oligomenorrhea, light periods, hypomenorrhea, loss of periods, amenorrhea. And these are related to just imbalances in either prostaglandins or the sequences of how FSH and LH impact ovarians and ovulation. All the different mechanisms that can impact ovulation, like hypothyroidism, can be a factor. Having too much estrogen can lead to heavier periods. Ovarian insufficiency, menopause, light bleeding. It gives you some general clues, but what I wanted to do is give you like very specific clinical applications to some of these things. So if you have a person that has lost their menstrual cycles or has inconsistent menstrual cycles, you really want to look at mechanisms like the suppressed pituitary gonadal axis or things that cause ovarian failure, loss of ovarian function, and maybe even a better way to say it. But this is the most common list here. The most common cause of women to lose their menstrual cycles, have inconsistent menstrual cycles, is PCOS, obesity. Prolactinoma, it's not uncommon. Prolactinomas, you see all the time if you do a lot of brain MRIs with people. I do a lot of head injury work, so I do brain MRIs, see prolactinomas all the time. But with prolactinomas, you can measure serum prolactin, you can see it elevated. People that have prolactinomas will have like milky discharge of the breast. If you ask them about, they'll notice, or sometimes they'll notice that they're dripping. Males or females, same thing. They have these prolactinoma patterns. That can be a factor, but PCOS, obesity are definitely the main causes of that. Medications, especially things like steroids, can have an impact on those. Certain powerful antifungals can impact that as well. And then the other key thing with the things that they're suppressing the pituitary, we talked about earlier, the main medications that can really impact pituitary function, FSH and LH, glucocorticoids, opioids, anabolic steroids, progestins, estrogens, oral contraceptives. Remember, there's some progestins and estrogens unreported in cosmetics, especially face masks and facial lotions. You always have to look for those when you have irregular menstrual cycles or missed cycles. Brain injury can impact the hypothalamic pituitary pathways. Prolactin, we talked about. Endocrine senescence just means like someone's getting older. But obesity, PCOS, those are major factors. Severe inflammation, oxidative stress, severe alcoholism, severe overtraining, those things can all impact LH and FSH output and then lead to missed or irregular menstrual cycles. The other part of this is ovarian failure. So people sometimes develop autoimmune premature ovarian failure. You can look at ovarian antibodies to confirm that. Early senescence, just genetically, some people get into menopause much sooner. Perimenopause, menopause, that's always a red flag when someone starts to miss cycles, that especially if they're 45 and older, that they're really getting to perimenopause. And then caloric deficit. If someone is not getting enough calories, they can lose their menstrual cycles. So that's another very common one. Most common ones would be like caloric deficit, PCOS, obesity, some people metabolic overtraining, those would be the main ones. Now, if someone has heavy or light bleeding with regular intervals, so they have their period, it's just that they have heavy bleeding when they have their period, or they have very light periods, then these can be not a decreased or higher low BMI. Typically, those that have low body mass index will have a tendency to have light bleeding stress, poor diet, prostaglandin balance, dysglycemia, hypothyroidism. Those are the things that have to be ruled out with heavy or light bleeding. And then with heavy menstrual bleeding, with irregular intervals, menorrhagia, you have to rule out anatomy, diseases, or proliferative patterns. Now, things like PCOS and obesity, hypothyroidism can definitely cause abnormal interval bleeding. But there needs to be a careful evaluation of reproductive anatomy for cancers and also for things like fibroids and polyps. They definitely need a gynecological examination to make sure they don't have any type of anatomical growths. Polyps or malignancy, benign tumors, follicle dysfunctions, these things can lead into mechanisms of metarrhagia. The ones you're most worried about is cancer. Anytime anyone has bleeding, that's abnormal timing is a red flag. Postmenopause, menstrual bleeding is definitely a red flag to rule out cancers. But pelvic anatomy conditions need to be ruled out if their menstrual bleeding is abnormal timing. That's always a major concern. And then when you're looking at people that have predictable clinical symptoms that occur from the luteal phase, the first day of the period, when they have PMS, premenstrual dysphoric disorder, menstrual migraines, PMS, what they're really having is some kind of imbalance between the physiological interactions between hormones, prostaglandins, neurotransmitter, and vascular dynamics. So within a normal menstrual cycle, hormones like estrogen, progesterone, T3, T4, testosterone, GH, DHA, or working in combination with neurochemicals in the hypothalamus, pituitary axis, like serotonin, dopamine, GABA, and so forth, and they're working with vascular dynamics in the blood vessels like nitric oxide and vasoactive peptide and vascular endothelial growth factor, and with prostaglandins, all working together for modulation of blood flow of the brain, reproductive tissue and organs, neurochemical activity in the brain, modulation of fluid retention and excretion. And when any of these systems are off balance, you can have physiological interactions that are dysfunctional in these pathways. So it could be someone who's got prostaglandin dietary imbalances, could be someone who's got hypothyroidism, got someone who's got metabolic overtraining syndrome suppressing the FSH-LH pathways impacting testosterone and estrogen. These are not uncommon. It could be someone who's got severe brain injury, they're not getting neurochemical pathways working after a TBI. But these integration issues can then lead to things like PMS, PMDD, menstrual migraines, and postmenopausal syndromes. So you, as a clinician, you're looking for how to get these systems efficient, where is the imbalance, but there's no specific protocol. You have to look for those mechanisms yourselves. Now, with all of these types of menstrual irregularities, they can all be caused by hypothyroidism. So the minute you find any kind of hormone imbalance, and especially the minute you find any kind of menstrual abnormality, you need to look for hypothyroidism. And when we say hypothyroidism, I mean like elevated TSH. Do they actually have hypothyroidism? Are they in a state where their pituitary is pumping out lots of thyroid-stimulating hormone because their tissues don't have enough thyroid hormones, T3 and T4? Now, T3 and T4, they support ovarian metabolism and mitochondrial function. They actually activate the enzymes for steroidogenesis. They optimize pituitary and ovarian hormone receptors. They optimize endometrium and metabolism and mitochondrial function in the endometrium itself. They support hepatic microbiome band transformation of hormones. They activate brain and neurochemical cellular dynamics. They modulate vascular dynamics. It's, things will not work in menstruation physiology when there's insufficient T3, T4. And with hypothyroidism, with T3, T4 levels down, and there's impairment of pituitary hypogonadal access, you can get oligomenorrhea, amenorrhea, missed menstrual cycles, loss of menstruation. You can have impaired estrogen to progesterone output and get light or heavy bleeding, and you can have abnormal distributed endometrial shedding and proliferation and get different types of polyps and different types of growths leading to menorrhagia. And then prostaglandins are also impacted by T3 and T4, which can lead to PMS type patterns. So always, you always have to rule it out. So key concept, always rule out hypothyroidism with any form of menstruation cycle abnormality by running serum TSH. Okay? Now, you could have subtle like T4 to T3 conversion issues impacting menstrual cycle pathways. You could have someone who's got not enough free thyroid hormones. But the one that you really for sure need to rule out is actual hypothyroidism with high TSH. Okay. Now, in addition to hypothyroidism throwing all these pathways off, polycystic ovary syndrome is another one. And PCOS can cause every single menstrual hormone, every single menstruation disorder. And the key concept is always rule out PCOS with insulin resistance with any form of menstrual cycle abnormality. Anytime serum DHA testosterone is elevated, focus on PCOS management. So how do you identify PCOS? You can get, like, someone can do an ultrasound and see increased growths on the ovaries, this polycystic pattern. Sometimes you can identify PCOS by looking at their like testosterone levels. If you ever see really high DHA or testosterone levels, whether it's saliva, urine, or serum testing in a female, you're always thinking of PCOS. So when that 17-20 lysine enzyme gets activated, androsterone, DHEA, testosterone go up. So anytime you see any of those androgens up and they're not taking those replacement compounds, you definitely want to suspect PCOS. Now, the levels of testosterone and androgens do fluctuate in females. You may not always see it. So another thing you have to be aware of is if you see someone who's got signs of insulin resistance or metabolic syndrome, then you may really suspect PCOS as a kind of as a cause of menstruation disorder. And you may not even want to run into all this extensive hormone testing with someone if they have some menstrual abnormalities if you clearly have metabolic syndrome with the person, because you just may be wasting a patient's time and money. Or you might say, let's check hormones, let's check your reproductive hormones after we get your blood sugar and insulin are controlled a little bit and see what kind of impact that has on it. Because you could have someone who's got abnormal menstrual cycles or heavier bleeding, and as soon as you start to get their metabolic syndrome under control, like those things completely normalize and you hadn't wasted all this time and energy doing hormone testing. So remember, with PCOS, this hyperandrogenism state fluctuates. What's going to be more stable for you to look at will be like symptoms of insulin resistance, main ones being fatigue after meals, sugar cravings after meals. If you're looking at routine lab work, if you ever see their glucose levels starting to become elevated outside the normal range, elevated HbA1, those pre-diabetes states, when they can't get glucose into their cells because they have insulin resistance, you'll see their triglycerides start to go up. Anytime you see triglycerides high, especially above their total cholesterol, those are clues to you that they may really have this PCOS pattern. And I would say in the early parts of my career, I would go, okay, they might have PCOS. Let me run all these female hormone profiles panels and see if they actually have it. Let me confirm it. Let's get an ultrasound. Let's do all these things. And it really wasted a lot of time, energy, and money. And a different approach I find more useful is to go, you do definitely have this insulin resistance pattern, metabolic pattern. Why don't we try to calm that first for the next 60 days and see what happens? And then if not, then let's dive into these hormones more aggressively. But you may have your menstrual cycle abnormalities completely change as you get your insulin levels down, as you get your insulin levels under control. I find that to be much more effective. Now, with PCOS, with this polycystic ovarian syndrome, you get these cysts all throughout the ovaries that you can see in an ultrasound. Sometimes they're clear in ultrasound, and sometimes they're not, but the lab panels completely show you'll have someone has a pelvic ultrasound, normal findings, and they have high testosterone, high estrogen, high testosterone, insulin resistance, clearly on lab work. They still have PCOS. It's just not identified clearly with the ultrasound. Ultrasound testing is done 100%. And you can't discount labs if you see, even if you have a normal pelvic ultrasound. So ultimately, you get faulty ovulation, the androgen levels throw off FSH, LH levels. We talked about some of the mechanisms of PCOS, but physical things that really promote insulin resistance, PCOS, obesity, obesogens, some genetic involvement, and then even get dysbiosis as part of the vicious cycle. And the main things like insulin resistance, hyperandrogenism, hormone imbalances, FSH, LH levels can be completely thrown off. The many hair loss in a female, the most common cause is actually PCOS. It's not hypothyroidism. You see any kind of facial hair growth, weight gain, you see some early signs of insulin resistance. It's much, much more likely that you're dealing with a patient that really has PCOS. This paper called Polycystic Ovarian Syndrome, Challenges Possible Solutions, that was published in the Journal of Clinical Medicine. It's a good review of PCOS, but here's some very important points. PCOS is one of the most common endocrine disorders in women of reproductive age. It's actually not one of the most common. It's the most common. Okay? This syndrome not only impairs female fertility, but also increase the risk of obesity, diabetes, dyslipidemia, cardiovascular diseases, psychological diseases, and other health problems. Additionally, because of high clinical heterogeneity, the current pathogenesis of PCOS is still uncured. There's still a large gap in precise diagnosis and individualized treatments. So there isn't a standard approach, and clearly the models we're using right now, which is androgen blockers and birth control pills, is not really treating the underlying issue. But when you see a patient that has weight gain, acne, facial hair growth, impaired ovulation, menstrual cycle irregularities, patterns of insulin resistance, you definitely need to focus on the PCOS pathway. Okay? And then this paper goes on to say, PCOS is a lifelong reproductive, metabolic, and psychiatric disorder that affects 5 to 18% of women, which is associated with a significantly increased lifetime risk of concomitant diseases, including type 2 diabetes, psychiatric disorder, and gynecological cancers. Because it's lifelong because it's not being treated properly. It doesn't have to be lifelong. But in the healthcare system, many women have lifelong issues. One, because the patients are not actually focusing on their healthcare. This takes an active participant model to change your lifestyle, to make changes with their insulin resistance pattern. And two, they're just not getting enough information other than taking oral contraceptives to make it appear like they have a normal cycle again, and the androgen blockers, those things aren't enough to really change these patterns for many women. And then this goes into the clinical presentation of abnormal menstrual cycles and facial hair growth and acne and infertility, hair loss, but really the bigger issue is like severe depression, type 2 diabetes. And then obstructive sleep apnea is common as PCOS patients develop increased body fat. And the combination of these things gets them stuck in a vicious cycle that's really hard to get out of. And certain people have greater risk for PCOS because of their genetic susceptibility. And they get stuck in this vicious cycle for a very long time. This was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. But the hyperinsulinemia, and you see the adrenal gland production of androgens, and you can see, for example, alteration of their FSH receptors And you can see this pituitary feedback loop of 17 to 20 lice being overactivated, leading to increasing androgens in the ovaries. The studies, again, the relationship between microbiome dysfunction that's involved with regulation of insulin, crosstalk between gut metabolites that control blood sugar levels, and things between adipocyte connections, the web we talked about, and insulin become really important. And even things like short-chain fatty acid production from fiber sources, which impact insulin receptor signaling, and things like leaky gut are all associated with this pathophysiology of PCOS. Functional medicine practitioners really can sometimes treat the whole web of PCOS and make a big difference with them. Getting their inflammation down with anti-inflammatories, really working on their insulin resistance with diet, nutrition, lifestyle, compounds like berberine, myo-inositol, alpha-lipoic acid, getting their microbiome more diverse, supporting their gut health, getting them to move. Those things can all really have a big difference on the PCOS web. So those are the main things you should be aware of. Clinically, when you look at patients that have menstrual irregularities, prostaglandin imbalances, hypochloric issues with diet, abnormal patterns of things like metabolic overgrowth syndrome, suppressing FSH and LH, but the main and most common one would be like PCOS. Now, you'll have one group of menstrual irregularity patients that are like the PCOS pattern that are normal body weight. Those will definitely be missed in the healthcare system. So if you're looking for early markers of insulin resistance with lab work and symptoms of insulin resistance, you'll find those patients all the time. You'll have another group of patients that have abnormal menstrual cycles or missed menstrual cycles. That will be like the low body weight, adrenal exhausted patient, cold hands, cold feet. You have to talk them into getting enough protein and fats in their diet, and they're going to struggle through that and try to get to a normal body weight because they're underweight, try to get them stabilized by eating more frequently. That could take several weeks for them to get adjusted to that until their cycles come back. So those are the very common things you'll see. Now, let's talk about perimenopause. So as we look in the female hormone transitions, perimenopause is a clear period of time where women will have their quality of health drop significantly. And they will develop diseases and develop symptoms, and their health for the first time in their life will go the wrong way. And when you're looking at the changes in characteristics of perimenopause onset, this is when now the menstrual cycles are changing, they're getting heavier or longer, they get short menstrual cycles, they get longer menstrual cycles, they notice swollen, lumpy breast, increased menstrual cramps, mid-sleep awakening, they have the onset of night sweats, sweating attacks throughout the day, they might start to have migraine headaches for the first time, they have severe changes in mood, premenstrual mood swings that they didn't have before, their body weight can change, and for most people it becomes very obvious to them if they have hot flashes. So hot flashes are caused by rapid estrogen fluctuations, they're not caused by estrogen deficiency, we talked about that earlier, and this is a paper that was published called Clearing Confusion About Perimenopause. This transition to menopause or perimenopause was formerly thought to involve dropping estrogen levels. However, estrogen levels are known to average 30% higher and to be chaotic and to be associated with less progesterone. So what they show in the studies, what we talked about earlier, is in perimenopause, it's not that they're estrogen deficient. The assumption is that they're estrogen deficient because as soon as they go on estrogens, their hot flashes stop, but it's not an estrogen deficiency issue, and they then have high estrogens that may put them at risk for different proliferative conditions and embolisms and strokes and other health problems. But in perimenopause, you can see, like in premenopause, their mid-cycle luteal phase, things are pretty consistent. Perimenopause, they're chaotic and scattered. But their estrogen levels aren't dropping. They can sometimes even much higher. It's not until they get full ovarian failure that their levels start to get stable and much lower. And for some people, they're still within normal healthy limits on the average of their normal cycle when they're menstruating, where there is no really major health concerns. So this is where hot flashes occur as they have these chaotic patterns. Once they get to this pace where their levels are stable, not spiking, there's no more hot flashes. But the key thing is symptoms. Now realize that when you look at the average female, 20% are asymptomatic. So 20% of women would be like, yeah, it was easy, no big deal. Why are you guys complaining? Very easy, no problem. For the most part, those are probably those that had healthy adrenal gland adaptation. And then when you look at the other 80%, 30% of them only had hot flashes, nothing else. But 70% of them had hot flashes plus cognitive dysfunction and insomnia and mood changes and depression and something else. 80% of people are going to have hot flashes. Of those, 30% just hot flashes, and 20% are going to be asymptomatic. The asymptomatic ones that you're not going to see in your office, not going to be too worried about, they're not going to come in with severe symptoms. But the ones that are having symptoms are really going through these hot estrogen spikes that they can't compensate for. Either adrenal gland function is going to compensate for them, or estrogen replacement will keep them high all the time and then compensate for their vasomotor effects. Estrogen replacement comes in and goes, okay, no more spikes. Everything is normal, and that stops your vasomotor symptoms. Now, this estrogen elevation like this can cause more depression in some females. It can cause weight gain and fluid retention in some females, and some of them will just won't feel good on it. As soon as they go on it, they're like, I don't care. I'd rather have the hot flashes. We have to be conscious of what are the other approaches. The other approach is really to look at things like selective estrogen receptor modulator, support through adrenal glands, and go from there. So the adrenal glands are going to be really critical in perimenopause because they can compensate and help these spikes not be so aggressive, which can help control these severe symptoms they're having with hot flashes and depression and mood changes. So remember that 10 to 30% of reproductive hormones in males and females are synthesized by the adrenal glands. When you have adrenal, like when you look at perimenopause and there's these spikes of estrogens, the adrenal glands can come in and compensate. Then all of a sudden these spikes are not so aggressive. They can get to the point where the patient becomes completely asymptomatic, or they can function with where they're at. And when we say adrenal support, we mean like some of the nutraceuticals we talked about for adrenals, like adaptogens, but really proper sleep, keeping their blood sugar 100% perfect, getting some exercise and movement, things that improve their stress resiliency. Those are going to be the key things you're going to have to do in perimenopause and see if it has an effect. The best scenario is to make sure a person has a normal adrenal cortisol profile before they get into perimenopause. If in that age group where their mom or their sister were starting to get into perimenopause and they're close to that age group and they want to know how to improve their health, make sure they have a healthy adrenal cortisol rhythm throughout the day, that those levels are balanced and perfect, and go from there. Perimenopause promotion of dysglycemia. So perimenopause, there's loss of this ovarian pituitary feedback coordination. So there's fluctuating levels of estrogens that are happening. Adrenal gland, out of estrogens and estrogen precursors, they're there to help stabilize the spikes of estrogens. And this constant need for these adrenal glands to put all these estrogen precursors can put a stress on the adrenals, fatigue the adrenal reserves. There's only so much energy, mitochondria, cellular function the adrenal glands have. It's not unlimited. And then under the stress of perimenopause, it's not uncommon for some women or many women in perimenopause to, for the first time, really start developing hypoglycemia patterns or insulin resistance patterns. And these are going to cause their own list of symptoms, some of them contributing to the mood disorders, to their energy fluctuations, to their depression. But it's going to be not uncommon to see many women that go through perimenopause have their blood sugar patterns made worse or be expressed for the first time in their health lifespan. Okay, the role of the adrenal cortex in perimenopause, ovarian loss of FSH receptor sensitivity. So that means the ovaries aren't responding to FSH anymore, normal part of aging. It leads to fluctuating levels of FSH and estradiol. Adrenal cortex upregulates androstenedione synthesis. Androstenedione is converted into estrogens by the enzyme aromatase in adipose tissue. And perimenopause and menopause estradiol compensation. Now, the adrenal glands put out their own hormones, but a large part of adrenal gland output is these precursors like DHEA and androstenedione. And the reason this slide's here is because you're going to see a lot of women that are completely, that are underweight, that don't have enough body fat, have a hard time compensating in perimenopause. So the conversion of precursor androstenedione and DHEA into estrogens is also important. So healthy adrenal gland function and then having normal body mass index, having some body fat, can be a critical way to allow the person to compensate for their pituitary ovarian feedback loop loss. the key concept being that adrenal glands are there to compensate for these drops through producing estrogen themselves or producing precursors that then aromatize into estrogens to allow for that normal, smooth transition. Now, other things that happen in perimenopause is there's definitely changes in adrenal function and blood sugar control. So glucose metabolism in the brain during menopausal transition. And premenopause, if you look at glucose metabolism in the brain, it's functioning at a very high level. And then as they get this fluctuation of hormones into perimenopause, boom, glucose metabolism in the brain is compromised. Part of that is the insulin resistance that develops and hypoglycemia that develop. But this is a major factor to why you get a lot of depression and mood disorders that occur. And if they can keep their blood sugar levels stable in perimenopause and adrenal glands healthy, then they may not get the most common symptoms associated with the hot flashes, which is going to be changes in mood and energy and patterns of depression and anxiety. Okay, there's another really important concept to be aware about. In perimenopause, you get this onset of inflammation that turns on, that may not turn off even after hormone levels are restored. Every single person, as they head into perimenopause, has some degree of pre-existing inflammation from whatever the color, from whatever their sources may be. Okay, and when there's a drop in estrogens, there's an upregulation of the pro-inflammatory cytokine activity leading to greater inflammation. Okay, estrogen support during or after upregulation of cytokine activity has limited influence on restoring pre-existing pro-inflammatory activity. So one of the things that I want to show you some studies on is one of the reasons why there's such a significant decline in women's health as soon as they hit perimenopause. Not just symptoms, but the overall health declines dramatically, is because the sudden drop of these estrogen levels that lead to spikes and fluctuations actually churn on the inflammatory system of the body and upregulates it like never before. And that ongoing upregulation of the inflammatory pathway can then continually promote things like neurodegeneration, systemic pain, systemic inflammation, bone loss, and so forth. We know that when people have hot flashes, they have the estrogen spikes. But these estrogen spikes not only cause the vasomotor symptoms, they also cause upregulation of the inflammatory system. And this is really important. So when they're having these spikes, they're actually upregulating the inflammatory pathways. So like a pre-existing knee injury or back injury all of a sudden hurts more. A little bit of neuroinflammation had in their brain now is really severe. Now they have severe brain fog. Their inflammatory bowel disease or their subtle celiac is much, much more reactive than ever before. And these are things that are related to this shift and the inflammatory upregulation that takes place when there's the inability to compensate for these estrogen fluctuations in perimenopause. Key concept, sharp declines in estradiol levels in perimenopause upregulate the inflammatory cytokine system. Estrogen modulation that dampens spikes of estradiol may reduce the inflammatory response. However, the inflammatory response may stay upregulated to some degree even after estrogen levels are restored with replacement therapy. And this has been identified with papers like this, titled Changes in Pro-Inflammatory Cytokine Activity After Menopause. There's now a large body of evidence suggests that the decline in ovarian function with menopause associated with a spontaneous increase in pro-inflammatory cytokines. The cytokines that have obtained the most attention are IL-1, 6, and TNF-alpha. Estrogen deficiency has been shown to enhance the responsiveness of cells towards these cytokines by upregulating the cytokine receptor number and cofactors of cytokine action, amplifying the effects of cytokine release. What they're showing in this paper is it's not only that the inflammatory cytokine levels go up, but the receptor sites increase in number and become more sensitive to causing an inflammatory reaction during this perimenopausal change. This is why it's so important to not let women have uncompensated transitions in perimenopause. You want to make sure their prostaglandins are healthy, their diet's healthy, their adrenal glands are healthy. They don't have this massive fluctuation of the endocrine system that turns on the neuroendocrine immune system towards a very severe inflammatory state. They go on in this paper, they show that estrogen deficiency has been shown to enhance the unresponsiveness of cells towards inflammatory cytokines, upregulating cytokine receptor numbers and messengers that amplify inflammatory effects. Again, it's not going to be uncommon for you to, as a clinician, needing to provide patients in perimenopause and in menopause much higher amounts of antioxidants, anti-inflammatories, things like glutathione, resveratrol, turmeric, just to help reduce their overall inflammation and improve their quality of health, just because of some of these neuroendocrine changes that take place. Here's another paper that was published. Increased severity of hot flashes was associated with adverse changes in vascular inflammation, further supporting the role of hot flashes in cardiovascular prognosis in these women. And this can then, as their inflammation goes up, they can damage the blood vessels, they can damage the bone, they can damage the brain pathways. There's evidence that estrogen deficiency may also enhance the responsiveness of IL-6. You don't want IL-6 more responsive. Through modulating IL-6 insulin pathways, this causes severe bone loss, severe neuroinflammatory promotion. This is another paper that was published. Estrogens influence antioxidant enzymes, superoxide dismutase and glutathione peroxidase. Significantly lowered glutathione peroxidase levels has been seen in menopause. So not only is estrogen drops and spikes in perimenopause promote more inflammatory cytokines, cause greater number of inflammatory cytokine receptors on tissues, and greater amplification of these cytokine responses that take place for inflammation, but it also, as estrogen levels drop, it actually reduces the person's ability to make antioxidants, which then promotes the problem. Furthermore, seems like it appears that production of inflammatory prostaglandins and COX enzymes is promoted by increased production of inflammatory cytokines. So as they get into these drops of estrogen patterns, this was by ovarectomy, where they measured these levels, they immediately shifted into pro-inflammatory prostaglandins. So even if they were taking omega-6s, their desaturase enzyme shifted in such a way where they went into an inflammatory state. So key concept, essential fatty acid levels are directed not only by dietary consumption, but also by physiological factors. In perimenopause, there's increased development for PG2 and a greater need for PG1 and PG3 levels with diet. So there's also these shifts in perimenopause with impacting the nitric oxide system away from endothelial nitric oxide synthase that helps stimulate anti-inflammatory pathways and blood flow towards cytokine-inducible nitric oxide synthase, which promotes inflammation throughout their whole body. So in perimenopause, it's common to see what's called INOS expression go up for tissue destruction, tissue inflammation. ENOS pathways go down, which means less blood flow to tissues. NNOS pathways go down, which means decreased synapses. Like, all this stuff is why you see this rapid decline in health in women as soon as they hit perimenopause. That sudden drop of estrogens is a really big deal because it just turns on these expressions of these inflammatory pathways that then promote chronic disease development. Here you can see like a summary of some of these things that are happening from the neuroendocrine immune response to perimenopause. You see the normal response in perimenopause, pituitary FSH, ovaries not responding to FSH efficiency. That leads to FSH going up, estradiol levels going down and spiking. Estradiol levels spiking down, becoming lower, decreased antioxidant levels. There is upregulation of INOS, there's upregulation of cytokines, there's systemic inflammation, there's prostaglandin shifts, there's a drop in progesterone, and this leads to inability to produce estradiol peaks, LH surges. You get all these different types of dysregulation in the system altogether. Furthermore, studies have shown leaky gut develop. Estradiol modulates pericellular permeability in tight junctions, function in endothelial and reproductive tissue. So, you know, drops in estrogens activate these cytokine surges. These cytokine surges cause activation of glial cells and breakdown of the blood-brain barrier, and also breakdown of the tight junction in the gut, causing leaky gut. And these promote the whole systemic inflammatory response. And longitudinal studies conducted across the world, diverse populations, confirm that women are 2 to 5 times more likely to experience depressive disorders during perimenopause. This is from a neuroinflammatory point of view, more than anything else. And the loss of ovarian function during menopause transition has a profound impact on female skeletal health. And it currently is estimated that 1 in every 2 Caucasian women will experience an osteoporotic fracture during their lifetime, contributing to considerable morbidity, enormous economic burden with the aging female population. So these inflammatory mechanisms are all turned on with these perimenopausal drops and spikes, and then these things really promote bone resorption, turns on these osteoclast activities, And as women transition into menopause, you can see their bone mineral density go down dramatically. A study that was done, bone mineral density loss in years after final menstruation period dramatically goes down. And these are mitigated with anti-inflammatory approaches, vitamin D, not so much by calcium at this age, and having proper hormones. Estrogens have both tissue proliferative effects and they have immunological effects. And in perimenopause, as they lose their HPO axis coordination, they turn on inflammatory prostaglandins, nitric oxide isomer shifts, neurochemical imbalances, compromised barrier system microglia upregulation, and they get all these various symptoms, everything from pain all throughout their body, multiple food sensitivities, the underlying inflammatory condition getting worse, altered cortisol rhythm, sleep imbalances, adrenal dysfunctions for the first time, blood sugar levels getting worse, brain fog, hot flashes, bone density loss. So, you know, they get into this vicious cycle that we've talked about here. Antioxidant reserves go down, more inflammation, nitric oxide isomer shift, pro-inflammatory cytokines, neuroinflammation, breakdown of the blood-brain barrier, breakdown of the gut barrier, bone loss, non-adaptive stress responses, and so forth. In this paper here, they go on to say that the magnitude of the postmenopausal increase in pro-inflammatory cytokine production may depend to a great state on the extent of the pro-inflammatory stimuli that a person that are present in the cellular environment at the time of menopause. So the more inflammation the patient has going to menopause, the worse these systems get. And the more efficient they are in stabilizing their estrogen fluctuations with healthy adrenal gland functions and body fat aromatase, the less likely that these inflammatory patterns get turned on. Key concept, the patient's pre-existing inflammatory cytokines will determine which systems are most impacted by the upregulation of inflammatory cytokines from a loss of hypothalamic pituitary ovarian feedback. So these are all pre-existing patterns that can make perimenopause much, much worse. So if you're fortunate enough to work with a patient before they get into perimenopause, you want to lower their total inflammatory load, whatever is specific to these patients on this list. You want to make sure they have the highest amount of stress resiliency so they don't fall apart with stress, that they're getting adequate exercise, adequate sleep, their blood sugar levels are totally stable, their cortisol adrenal functions are ideal. And that would be the best scenario. Sometimes when they're in the scenario itself, in perimenopause, they weren't able to compensate, other things are there, then you have to treat the underlying inflammatory issues that show up. It's not going to be uncommon for patients that have pre-existing conditions to have them dramatically get worse or have fuel added to the fire as they go into that estrogen perimenopause fluctuation. So past brain injuries and neurodegeneration can be turned on by microglial activation. They can have significant change in cognitive decline. Cognitive endurance can go down. Depression, severe brain fog. Their osteopenia can dramatically turn into osteoporosis very quickly. Their allergies can get much worse. Perimenopause turns on mast cells. They get much more severe allergic reactions. They get much more progressed food sensitivities. All of a sudden, they're much worse than before. Their osteoarthritis now becomes much more severe. Their underlying joint inflammation gets activated. Now they have rapid joint degeneration. Their autoimmunity that was controlled all of a sudden is not. Now they get expressions of autoimmune that's worse, much, much worse. The underlying inflammatory conditions like IBS or inflammatory bowel disease turns on. They get increased flare-ups. They get more vascular inflammation that turns on. They're more prone for atherosclerosis. So the key things you want to transition to menopause with good underlying health is adrenal gland integrity, normal glycemic response, healthy antioxidant levels, healthy microbiome, anti-inflammatory state, get into perimenopause, have no symptoms during transition, reduce the expression of these promoted diseases. That would be like the ideal scenario. Now, when you look at people transitioning to menopause, you can have different examples. So for example, for a scenario here, example one, let's say you have a person who's a smoker, a diabetic, is consuming a pro-inflammatory diet and is obese. Their transition to menopause is going to be terrible. They're going to have extreme symptoms because of their underlying inflammatory conditions, right? So they can have hot flashes, pain, waking, insomnia, mood disorders. that may have their diabetes become very severe during this stage. You can have another scenario here where you have someone who's got a past traumatic brain injury, bumped their head a few times, didn't really notice much, hypoglycemia, they're underweight, they transition to menopause, and now severe cognitive decline, depression, brain fog, exhaustion. And then they have celiac disease or Hashimoto's, transition to menopause, and then they progress into hypothyroidism from their Hashimoto's, that was subtle. They have severe chronic leaky gut, severe hot flashes, new autoimmune diseases turn on, or you can have a scenario where someone had like a chronic hepatitis C viral infection, fatigue, malaise, brain fog, and now they have like severe liver cirrhosis and symptoms and so forth. Estrogen, at this point, is not going to combat all this stuff. So these are the key takeaway messages. Now, estrogens are important, but all these other factors are going to be critical, and maybe strategies to dampen your inflammation, maybe strategies to dampen autoimmunity, maybe higher needs for anti-inflammatory compounds, maybe the things that you need to do in perimenopause. Okay. Now, if we transition from perimenopause into menopause, you can see why many menopausal females end up with osteoporosis and neurodegenerative disorders and cognitive decline and cardiovascular disease, because they turn into a state of a heightened state of inflammation. And as they get into menopause and go through that perimenopause transition and their hormone levels start to drop, the bottom line is this pre-existing inflammatory state then causes these neurodegenerative diseases. So the goal is to combat their inflammation that can take place in perimenopause. That's really the main goal you have. And one of the questions you want to ask clinically is, what happened between your health? What did you notice in your health from when you were having menstrual cycles as you transitioned to perimenopause and now? They could focus on, my brain stopped working, had brain inflammation, couldn't think, severe depression. As a clinician, now you're really worried about them developing Alzheimer's. Or they could say, I got my bone density test back, I have severe osteoporosis, and now you're worried about inflammatory models of like bone health. These promotion of these pro-inflammatory patterns is really the most critical thing that you should be aware of. Okay, and these things also happen with not only natural menopause, but surgically induced menopause turns on these inflammatory cascades that really progress as well. Okay, with perimenopause, you get this inflammatory state that then promotes these degenerative diseases over a period of time. And this paper, they concluded compounds that directly interact with cytokine activity may be even more effective in neutralizing menopause-related cytokine changes than even just hormones itself. So it really becomes this battle of stopping that load and spikes and compensated estrogen fluctuations and managing the inflammation. Okay, last section here, let's talk about men. So we've already talked about early onset puberty, delayed onset puberty, and gynecomastia. So let's talk about what happens in adulthood, what happens with men as they become older. And men don't have this clear perimenopause state. They just have a decline in function over a period of time. Most common ones are going to be like low stamina, poor muscle recovery, low libido, mood disorders, reduced muscle mass, increased body fat. And they get into an inflammatory state just like perimenopause, which then leads into these degenerative diseases like Alzheimer's and osteoporosis and cardiovascular disease as well. Now, if you look at andropause, the signs and symptoms of andropause associated with testosterone deficiency are, number one, when you look at sexual symptoms, is loss of libido. Because loss of libido is a really big deal. It's your most direct clinical symptom with testosterone levels. That once a person loses their libido, you immediately know you need to check levels. General physical symptoms, their ability to recover from workouts, develop muscle mass is going to be really critical. The muscle endurance, how long they can go for a walk for, how long they do activities becomes really key issues. So those are important. Now, when you look at symptoms that were screened for men and looking at symptoms of andropause, one of the earliest, most significant early findings was memory impairment. Memory loss was important. 36% of patients who felt they had experienced andropause. That was more so than anything else. So one of the earliest red flags for low androgen activity is memory impairment, subjective cognitive impairments. Remember, we have different types of impairment. There's mild cognitive impairment, then there's dementia. But before you get mild cognitive impairment, you get subjective cognitive impairment. That's where you as the individual notice you're not as sharp as you used to be. and recalling facts and numbers and memory, and your own memory function, your memory and recall pathways are going down. That's subjective cognitive impairment. That's one of the earliest signs of androgen deficiency in males. Another major one, besides low libido, is loss of morning erections. Like with a male, like you ask him, hey, what's the last time you had a morning erection? They're like, what do you mean? That was when I was a kid. You're an adult. You're not having those anymore? No. That's a sign of androgen deficiency. Loss of motivation, those are also red flags. So when men get older, they just go, oh, I'm just getting older. My memory's going down. Morning erection, that doesn't happen when you get old. That's only for kids. I don't have a libido anymore. No, those are all signs of androgen deficiency. Those are all, you should have those into adulthood. You should have morning erections into adulthood. You should have libido into adulthood. You should have good cognitive function into adulthood. But they get overlooked in the healthcare system. Physicians don't ask for them, and it becomes a problem. We'll talk about using standardized questionnaires in the evaluation form to quickly identify andropause and use it as a tool to see if they're getting better with different types of treatments. But when you look at andropause, you're basically looking at decreased testosterone, and this pathway is really through luteinizing hormone stimulating these lytic cells to produce testosterone. And FSH involved with serotonin sperm production, but with primary hypogonadism, really looking at these LH pathways. So you can have dysfunction of the testes themselves. You can have dysfunction with the pituitary output of LH. You could have some men that either high or low LH with low testosterone is part of andropause. Low testosterone by itself doesn't tell you if a person has primary or secondary hypogonadism. They have low testosterone with high LH. That means they have testicular failure. Testes aren't working, so the luteinizing hormone is putting out more stimulation to make them work. Low LH and low testosterone means the pituitary is not working. It's not the gonads that aren't working, but the pituitary is not putting out LH. Low testosterone by itself doesn't help you tell you what the whole picture. You need the LH with it. Estrogen is another big issue. A lot of men convert testosterone estrogens through aromatization. And then some men convert their testosterone to 5-alpha reductase, which can be very good for them because it gives them androgenic effect. But in some cases, it causes receptor site downregulation and they get symptoms of low testosterone. And DHT also is one of the main reasons men get androgenic alopecia and have hair loss. That's why you see a lot of men using steroids. Their DHT levels go high, they get hair loss. And you also see prostate hypertrophy. High DHT and high estrogens really promote prostate hypertrophy. Okay, so these are all the main things you have to be aware of as a clinician that can lead to men having low androgen patterns. So let me go through them one by one. Primary hypogonadism means there's lytic cell dysfunction. The testicular cells aren't working. In those cases, LH is up and total testosterone is down. Sometimes lab LH is normal because the LH is way too broad. I'll show you some numbers about that. But the key thing, primary hypogonadism, is the lytic cells are not healthy. And the main cause of that, like we talked about, is really inflammation. Systemic inflammation, too much free radicals, too much oxidative stress will directly damage the blood testes barrier and impact lytic cell function and reduce testosterone output. Several studies have shown these clear relationships, direct relationships between pro-inflammatory levels and testosterone levels. This was a study of 3,041 men that looked at the association between inflammation, testosterone, and sex hormone binding globulin levels. As your TNF-alpha goes down, testosterone levels drop. Total testosterone for all these other inflammatory mediators, doesn't really matter which one. They all show a clear relationship with inflammation dropping testosterone levels. These lytic cells are very prone to injury from just subtle inflammation. Subdermal testosterone may already in young age associate low-grade systemic inflammation, which may be part of the mechanism underlying adverse outcomes of male hypogonadism. In young men, you definitely have to think of a chronic inflammatory mechanism that's impacting their health. You could have people, you have like a young male who's got celiac disease, you get him off gluten, everything is normal. You get a person who has hypogonadism as a male, very low testosterone, they have uncontrolled HbA1c levels, they're pre-diabetic, you get under control, everything normalizes there. So those are things you have to be aware of. Lots of studies that are showing chronic low-grade inflammation is linked to low androgen levels in males. That's the main reason why men have their testicular lytic cells fail. Now, then you have secondary hypogonadism, where the pituitary system is dysfunctional, And this we've gone over before, medications, overtraining syndromes, high degrees of inflammation, these things that can impact the LH levels. Now, one thing to know about LH levels is LH levels are really broad. So if you look at a serum adult LH level, it's like 1.8 to 8.6. This is like a most typical range. And one of the things you might want to do, not just with LH, but other hormones if you're doing serum testing, is to take the range and just break it into an interquartile range. Basically, you look at the range between the low and high end divided by 4, and then you get your interquartile range. So, you know, if you see men that are like in this lower part of the interquartile range, even though within the normal really broad lab levels of LH for the general whole population, you know, in that first quartile range, you may suspect that they may have something suppressing their pituitary function. And if LH levels are in the fourth interquartile range, the highest end, then you may suspect something impacting their testicular cell function, like inflammation, hemochromatosis, testicular autoimmunity, or just aging causing the senescence of their cells. But always considering, people ask, what's a functional range? You want to do a functional range, and you don't have a lot of data or information, just go into an interquartile range. Take the range of numbers between the low and high, divided by 4, and then start looking at that. And just tell your patients, we're looking at your ranges more critically, we're looking at them in quartiles, we don't want you in either end of that spectrum. Those are things that are potentially red flags. Okay. So primary and secondary hypogonadism is either the pituitary is not working or the testes are not working. Now, there are men that have reduction of their bioavailable testosterone that takes place. So in these cases, they have normal testosterone, total testosterone, which is protein-bound levels. Remember, total testosterone is both free and protein-bound levels. But free fraction hormones are only about 1% to 2% of hormones. And when they're low, they don't have an impact on the pituitary feedback loop, so it doesn't impact LH. So if you see a person, a male patient, you always want to also check free testosterone, not just total testosterone. So they have normal LH, normal total testosterone, but low free testosterone. And if their sex hormone-binding globulin's up, this is a person that doesn't have enough bioavailable free testosterone. They have a binding globulin protein issue that's impacting their physiology. So they have their hormone all bound up to globulin. They don't have this free testosterone that can bind to tissue. They don't have bioavailable testosterone. So remember, free testosterone is really what binds to tissue. When it's bound to sex hormone-binding globulin, it's not able to have an effect. So that's why you always want to look at free testosterone levels as well, not just total testosterone. We gave the example of a person who has normal total testosterone, which is free testosterone, sex hormone binding globulin, all categorized together. But if you just look at the free testosterone levels, you can see a difference even though the total levels are normal. And if you look at the relationships between age is the main factor. One of the things that happens just by age alone is the free testosterone levels go down. So this was a study of 3,200 male subjects. And I look at different points in their lifespan, and what you can start to see is like around age 45, their free testosterone levels totally drops. They go drop every decade. Every 5 years, you see a significant drop in their total their free testosterone levels. Their total testosterone levels are totally fine. Their LH levels don't become abnormal until they're like age 74. This is a group of men that's been identified in the andropause literature that go, wow, these men are being ignored because everyone's just running total testosterone. They're not looking at free testosterone, but it's very clear age alone has an impact on these binding globulin levels. So you should always look at free. And these are men that can have their entire life turned around. They get on testosterone replacement therapy if their free testosterone's low. And there isn't this severe metabolic condition that's causing it. Just age alone impacts these binding globulin ratios and patterns. Here they looked at also one of the factors that actually accelerates this besides age, that was another covariate, was BMI. So they found age was one factor, but BMI was another factor. So the more body fat they had, the more likely they had lower testosterone levels. So you can see their free testosterone levels just drop with more body fat. So more body fat, older age, less likely they have free testosterone levels. And this may not cause an abnormal total testosterone, so they could be missed unless their free testosterone levels are checked. And this was a paper that was published and looked at 1,709 men called the Massachusetts Male Aging Study. Total testosterone declined cross-sectionally at 0.8% a year of age. The follow-up data was both free and albumin-bound testosterone declined about 2% a year, all significantly more steeply with baseline data. Sex hormone-binding globulin increased cross-sectionally at 1.6 per year. Sex hormone-binding globulin goes up as we age, total and the free testosterone goes down with age. Another paper, longitudinal effects of aging and serum total and free testosterone levels. Conclusion is, results strongly support the concept that effects of aging to lower both total bioavailable circulating testosterone levels, which is free testosterone, and relative constant rate independent of obesity, illness, medication, cigarette smoking, or alcohol intake. So obesity makes it worse, but it doesn't matter. Age alone, age is the only factor. So as you get older, it's very likely that the free testosterone levels drop. And then more studies really showing the same thing. This was a U.S. Biobank study that showed those relationships affects the free testosterone on 461 outcomes in 161 men. And they'll go on to show lifelong increased free testosterone had beneficial effects on increased bone mineral density, decreased body fat, had adverse effects on decreased HDL, increased risk of prostate cancer, androgenic alopecia, spinal stenosis, hypertension, context-dependent effects on increased hematocrit and decreased C-reactive protein. So there was just a total decline in health in men when their free testosterone levels were low compared to those that had normal levels. So this is a data bank of 161,000 men. If you're a male, you don't want your free testosterone low. It's going to cause lots of health problems for you down the road. Okay. So the key concept is low free testosterone is caused by increased sex hormone binding globulins. Sex hormone binding globulins go up, age being one of the main mechanisms. And then other mechanisms that increase sex hormone binding globulin besides age are just like elevated estrogens, exposure to spouse's estrogen creams. Sometimes your wife has an estrogen cream that causes a male to get exposed and their sex hormone binding globulin levels go up, free testosterone goes down. Some of the insulin-sensitizing medications, some genetic uniquenesses, cirrhosis, those things can all cause changes in sex hormone binding globulin. This was a review paper on sex hormone binding globulin and it went through and illustrated all the main mechanisms we just spoke about. If you want to read it, it has all the studies on there for you. So that's another key concept. So they don't have to have primary or secondary hypogonadism. They could just have age causing the free testosterone levels to go down that can lead to symptoms of andropause. Another main issue is this aromatization pathway. And with aromatization, basically the body fat is converting testosterone to estrogen. And daily estradiol production is about 35 to 40 micrograms per. But when men have increased activation of the adipocytes, they can get this aromatization pattern. Red flags for aromatization is spontaneous crying and emotional reactions in men, hot flashes, body weight gain around hips and breasts. Those are major clues of aromatization. And you could have men that have aromatization and also have their free testosterone levels drop and never show up for low total testosterone. That's why you need to do a full hormone workup. This was a study, plasma concentration of androgen and estrogens are influenced by body weight and obesity. Estrogen and estradiols are increased with testosterone and sex hormone binding globulin. And basically, the bottom line is the more body fat a person has, the more aromatization potential they have, the more estrogen conversion they get. And there's also some genetic uniquenesses that cause people to have more aromatization than other people. It's not just always body fat. You can have some people that have normal body fat but have high amounts of aromatization just because of their cytochrome P450, 181. So don't assume you have to be overweight to have aromatization for your male patients. And insulin is a major trigger. Testes are producing out androsteroidione and testosterone. They have body fat with increased aromatization. One of the variables is genetic susceptibility. Hyperinsulinemia is another thing that can upregulate this. And then inflammatory mediators can also upregulate this. The combination of these three factors are the main ones that we know about that causes testosterone conversion to estrogen. Inflammation activates body fat aromatase to then convert testosterone to estrogen. Insulin surges upregulate that pathway. And then men start to aromatize. Their LH can be normal. Their FSH could be normal. They just have high amounts of estrogens that can be measured. Now, you could have different variations of aromatization. You could have a person that has a genetic uniqueness of cytochrome P50-1A1. That's the main enzyme for aromatase. But they have normal body mass, they're not overweight. They have normal insulin. And they have slight inflammation, but they have very high aromatization, high estrogens. You could have another person that doesn't have any uniquenesses for aromatization, but they have lots of body fat, they have increased BMI, they have hyperinsulinemia, hyperinflammation, and they're aromatizing. You could have another person that has some susceptibility with this aromatization enzyme genetically. They have some mild insulin resistance, but they have a normal BMI, but they have inflammation that causes aromatization. So these are the main variables you want to look at. And then there are some men that just have inefficient androgen receptor signaling with age. So they have normal LH, their total testosterone is normal, their free testosterone is normal, they have normal estrogens, testosterone levels, circadian rhythms in men versus young versus old men. And part of this comes down to what's the range of testosterone. We can see the American Association of Endocrinologists says 200 is the cutoff range. Endocrine Society is 264. American Urological Association is 300. No one agrees. They have different ranges. But for most people that are working with men that have low testosterone, they're using 400 as a reference range. So you'll see most people that are working with male hormone disorders, the lab range may be 280 or 300, but they're looking at anything below 4. So there are some men that just have their androgen receptors that are insufficient. The levels of hormones are fine, so they could have low. They could have normal testosterone levels. Let's say it's 280 to 900. They could be like in the 300 range, still within normal, but have low testosterone. And you could have some men that are within their normal reference range anywhere along this and still have low testosterone representations. There are some people that have these patterns unrelated to significantly abnormal lab tests, and they call these like relative hypogonad men. But the common cutoff most people are using in healthcare is around 400. Sometimes giving a man a trial of testosterone when they have all the symptoms and they see like their lipid profiles change, their blood pressure change, all of a sudden, they get more lean body mass, body fat goes down. They still are within the normal reference range. You're not getting super physiological ranges, but they keep them within that normal reference range with some testosterone placement. That can have some increased effects. Then lastly here, when you look at men, testosterone can convert to 5-alpha, from 5-alpha reductase into DHT. DHT has a 2-fold higher affinity to bind to androgen receptors, 5-fold activation of androgen receptors, and some people think this is very beneficial. It is for a lot of people. But sometimes this DHT overexpression causes prostate hypertrophy, androgenic alopecia, which is the androgenic hair loss. And if it shuts down the receptor sites, they can get low androgen symptoms. These are all the main mechanisms that have been shown to increase this 5-reductase pathway. But there are some men and some physicians that go, you know what? I don't care. Having that DHT slightly up improves insulin sensitivity, improves cognitive function, improves libido. And for that patient, the benefits may be worth the slight increase that they may have prostate hypertrophy, and they'll just monitor their PSA, and maybe their androgenic alopecia is not that bad. It doesn't matter to them. And having that higher level may have some greater benefits. Ultimately, when you look at andropause patterns, let me give you a cue. So you can have one male that has low androgen symptoms. These are all 5 different examples of males that have andropause symptoms. One could have normal LH, normal total testosterone, their free testosterone's down, their estrone's up, their sex hormone binding globulin's abnormal, and they have reduced bioavailable testosterone, maybe just by age alone, and aromatization, maybe by age and body fat. Another person has low androgen symptoms. They have normal LH, normal total testosterone, low free testosterone, normal estrogen, normal sex hormone binding pattern. They have unclear paranoid hypogonadism, but most likely due to secretory cell efficiency. Maybe this is just from inflammation. They may have low androgen symptoms, LH is high, total testosterone is high. They may have primary hypogonadism. The glands are failing for whatever reason. Maybe it's autoimmune. Maybe it's just severe inflammation. You could have another person that has normal LH, normal total testosterone, low free testosterone, increased sex hormone binding globulin, increased estrogen, increased DHT. And they have reduced bioavailable biotestosterone. They have aromatization. They have excess 5-alpha reductase activity. And you could have another person that has secondary hypogonadism, primary pituitary, where LH and total testosterone and DHT are all down. They can have high aromatization, estrogens are high. So these are all the main patterns. And ultimately, there's this chronic inflammatory web with andropause. And just like with perimenopause, you can get disease development. They get all these different symptoms from the inflammation, from the aromatization that takes place in their systems. And eventually, they progress into neurodegenerative, cardiovascular disease patterns and bone loss and so forth. In summary, these are the different male and hormone disorders. These are different female hormone disorders.
You can find all of this information and more at drknews.com/podcast. There you'll find the show notes, readings, and links related to this episode. You can also find Dr. Karazian's blog at drknews.com. The best thing to do is sign up for his weekly newsletter, where he will update you on the latest research and clinical strategies related to chronic and autoimmune health conditions. On social, you can find him on Instagram, Facebook, and Pinterest with the username Datis Karazian. This podcast is for general informational purposes only. It does not constitute the practice of medicine, nursing, or other professional health care services, including the giving of medical advice. And note, no doctor-patient relationship is formed. The use of this information and the materials linked to the podcast is at the user's own risk. The content of this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Users should not delay or disregard obtaining medical advice for any medical conditions they have, and should seek the assistance of their healthcare professionals for any such conditions. To learn more about Dr. Karazian's disclosures and the companies he advises, please visit drknews.com/about.